Next case is State of Ohio versus Jermaine Baker. Mr. Gallick.
I would ask to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
That's your time.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, Donald Gallick on behalf of appellant Jermaine Baker. I come before the court today on a certified question between the 9th District and the 12th District. The issues of that certified conflict are semantical. Some might say they are trivial. But the ramifications of this disagreement is wide-ranging. I'd just like to begin by reiterating a quote from a dissent that I put in my brief, saying that this leaves indigent defendants in prison with limited options. There are dozens of cases in limbo right now because we can't agree on what a final sentencing order is in a criminal case. The instant case of Jermaine Baker, he went to a jury trial, jury convicted him. The trial judge issued a sentencing entry saying he was found guilty by a jury trial, and here's his criminal sentence. The 9th District holds that that is not a valid sentencing entry. It's not appealable because there was no plea. And you say, well, wait a second, you just said he was convicted by a jury trial. But the 9th District has interpreted now for approximately the past 18 months that Criminal Rule 32C says you must have a plea and a verdict in a sentencing entry. My interpretation of it is a plea or a verdict. Obviously, if there was a jury verdict, the individual didn't plead guilty or no contest. But the 9th District has taken the word plea. They're not talking about a dispositive plea, you know, a plea of guilty or no contest. They're saying, well, what was his plea at arraignment? Which raises the question, you know, does it really happen in Ohio courts where a defendant and his counsel comes in, Your Honor, we're here to plead guilty to everything in arraignment. Well, okay, but let's bring up a jury and have a trial anyway. I don't believe that happens in Ohio courts. I think if there's been a jury trial, there's been a not guilty plea at arraignment.
When there is an arraignment, isn't there an entry in the court, an entry put on as to what that plea was?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
I always remember it as a trial judge. You put an entry on that pled guilty, pled not guilty, whatever, and then you went to the trial, and this was kind of a news to me sort of case because I don't remember ever going back and putting the original plea in a subsequent entry. Is the 9th District alone in this, or is there other districts?
Justice Stratton, I believe they are alone in this, and it's news to you. It's also news to many trial judges in the 9th District, where I have, it's taken me some time to figure out what the 9th District was actually talking about. There was some hiding the ball here. At first we thought it was, well, he pled guilty, but the judge didn't say he accepted the guilty plea, or he accepted the guilty plea, but didn't say he made a finding of guilt. And we're really breaking this down. And I've had to go back in other cases before the trial judge and saying, this entry is no good, issue another one, to where trial judges are saying, I don't know what to do. How do I issue a final entry?
Follow the rule.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor, but what does the rule mean?
That's what they should do, isn't it?
No doubt about it, Your Honor. And this is actually a case, there's a lot of defense attorneys who would really like, and perhaps I would as well, like to lose this case. I often come before this court asking to lose. Because then we could open up thousands of appeals and say there's no jurisdiction. It doesn't say what his arraignment was. And Justice Stratton, your point is, well, isn't it in a journal entry, you know, prior in the case? But there's language that the 9th District puts in State v. Miller, and it says, this court will not search the record to look at other journal entries. It must be on one journal entry. And so then it gets into the question, do other interlocutory orders all have to be in the same journal entry? Motions on rulings to suppress, in limine rulings, motions dismiss. That the 9th District wants everything in one journal entry so it can look at all of the possible appellate issues in a single journal entry. I don't believe that's what Criminal Rule 32C is talking about.
What is the ruling that you're seeking from our court? I appreciate it's here on a certified conflict because the court has found its decision to be in conflict with others. But from your vantage point, what is the ruling that you'd have this court make in this case?
Your Honor, I think it's twofold. And I think first I would like this court to adopt the 12th District ruling that if there is an acceptance of a plea, perhaps the judge accepts the plea one day and sentences the other day. If that's in two different journal entries, that's okay. It doesn't all have to be in one single sheet journal entry. And that's what the 12th District said in its opinion. Okay, he pled over in this journal entry. He was sentenced in this. That's a final order. Okay, that's appealable. The second issue that I think this court should adopt is that if there's been a verdict in a jury trial or a bench trial, Criminal Rule 32C doesn't require any discussion of what his plea was, that any plea out of arraignment has nothing to do with the justiciability of an appeal. And that's why there are dozens of cases in limbo, because people, attorneys now, most of these are indigent defendants, they've abandoned the appeals. Okay, they've said, we don't know what a journal entry is, the trial judge can't get it right, let's just forget the appeal. And that's what Judge Carr was talking about in her dissenting opinion. For the most part, we have indigent defendants who are in prison now. Their 30-day period has run. The Ninth District says we have no authority to hear their appeal because we don't know what their plea at arraignment was. And so even if this court says, well, of course the 12th District is correct, what happens to these dozens of cases? You know, you can't go back and try and do a delayed appeal 18 months after the fact in some of the cases. It really creates a quandary. And that's why many people are really rooting for me to lose this case, so they can go back and say, well, look, there was no jurisdiction. There was no final order. So we would like to file a 30-day direct appeal from this 2005 case.
Are you aware of any other appellate districts that take this view as the Ninth?
Your Honor, I believe the Ninth is alone in this opinion. I will say this. I think opposing counsel did more extensive research than I did and found other more nuanced differences in other appellate districts. I know he cites the 4th District quite heavily. I think those differences are a little on the edge of what this is issue before this court. But I think what opposing counsel's done is show that this issue should be settled, because we shouldn't have any question at this point in Ohio law as to what a final criminal entry is that invokes an appellate court jurisdiction.
Your information is that there are several criminal appeals that have not been able to get heard by the Ninth District because of this confusion about what constitutes a final order subject to review by the appellate court.
That's exactly right. And I know myself and attorneys in other cases, mostly indigent defendants, have filed motions with the trial court, motion to correct journal entry, motion for resentencing, motion to nunk-pro-tunk sentencing entry. And after a couple of I think now most of the trial judges in the Ninth District know what the Ninth District wants. But again, it's a four-county jurisdiction. That's a lot of trial judges. But there are dozens of appeals that have never had a direct, perhaps I should say dozens of criminal cases that have never had a direct appeal because there's this been a fight going on between the Ninth District's interpretation of 32C and trial judges saying, I don't understand what the plea of arraignment has to do with you having a direct appeal.
How long has this been going on? You say there's dozens of inmates that have not been able to pursue an appeal of
yes.
their conviction in the Ninth District because of not having a final appeal order, and you're the first one to bring this to our attention?
Your Honor, I don't know how I get myself in these situations, but that's correct.
That's called good luck, Mr.
That's correct, Your Honor. The Miller decision, which really was the first case, I believe that appeal just went away. Was, I believe, March of 2007. Now, there were prior cases, and the Miller opinion, which is cited heavily, I think, by both opposing counsel and myself, refers to other opinions from 2005, 2002, where the Ninth District kind of hints that there's no jurisdiction and without this strict interpretation of 32C.
But up to that point, they're taking these appeals.
That's correct.
In the format that all of the trial judges are using, which does not include at arraignment, he pled not guilty, and therefore we went to a jury trial. Is that true?
Prior to March 2007, that's correct.
What happened in March 2007 that precipitated?
Your Honor, in the first three or four paragraphs of the State versus Miller decision, the court talks about stare decisis, and the Ninth District says, well, even though we've accepted many of these appeals and they don't strictly comply with Rule 32C, from now on we say there's no jurisdiction. And from now on, trial judges are going to have to get in line with 32C, or we're going to dismiss the appeals. Now, I cite one case that I had in the Ninth District where they went ahead and ruled on the merits, but a dissenting judge said, well, wait a second, this doesn't have the plea at arraignment. We don't have jurisdiction over the case. In that case, for some reason, they didn't have jurisdiction, but they ruled on the merits anyway. I can't explain that.
So what you're actually pointing to is an inconsistency within the Ninth District. Does it depend on the panel? Have you noticed a pattern here where you've got a panel makeup that's making this difference?
Your Honor, I'm trying to point it out in a rather nice way. I will say that there is one judge that has consistently wrote dissents saying, I don't understand what we're talking about. I don't understand how we don't have jurisdiction. And one case that I cite with a dissenting opinion says, hey, wait a second. Why are we deciding this on the merits if there isn't a final appealable order? I thought this court's holding was without the plea arraignment and strict interpretation, there's no final appealable order. How are we hearing the appeal? So certainly there is some disputes among the five judges. But the main thing I have been trying to do is practicing primarily in Summit County within the Ninth District is trying to figure out what the Ninth District actually said. There was quite a 6-month period where no one really knew. We would have the journal entry get remodified, keeps getting dismissed. I believe the Jermaine Baker case before the court was only dismissed once. That's good for me to only have the appeal dismissed once.
Is this an issue that only arises when there is a trial, either to the court or to the jury?
Not necessarily, because some of the cases, and I think I've cited at least a couple of them, certainly not all of them, where the judge says, well, defendant came before the court, pled guilty, we accepted the guilty plea, I sentenced him to 2 years. And there's some other problems. They say, well, one, what was his plea at arraignment? Or second, you didn't issue a finding of guilt. Okay, he pled guilty, you accepted his guilty plea, you didn't find him guilty.
My recollection was it doesn't say plea at arraignment, does it? It says plea.
Well, the Criminal Rule 32 says plea at arraignment, but in the case of Jermaine Baker,
I've got it in front of me. C says the judgment of conviction shall set forth the plea, the verdict or findings, and the sentence. Now, is that you have a different version of the rule than I do?
Or? Well, Your Honor, one is what does the word plea mean? Are we talking about a dispositive plea? Or are we talking about the initial plea at arraignment?
Well,
see, I say you can't.
Is that
question been litigated?
I think we're doing it right now.
I guess what I'm getting at is where is the confusion that we don't want to put in, or the trial courts don't put in the plea at arraignment when it proceeds to trial, or they don't put in the plea even when there is a change of plea and a conviction.
Justice Cupp, I think I understand what you're saying. I do remember seeing many journal entries saying defendant changed his original plea of not guilty to guilty or to no contest, and we entered a finding of guilt. I think that's correct. I think this probably comes up more in jury trials. Certainly, I handle more indigent appeals when there are jury trials that result in a guilty verdict, so you're going to see this more often. But, you know, to say you have to have a plea and a verdict, you say, well, you know, when a case is resolved, you don't have a plea or a verdict.
How hard is this to write an entry that way? I mean, in spite of the fact there's confusion and some don't do it, how difficult is it to do it?
Not very, Your Honor, once we're all on the same page, if I can use that language. However, you have to say if it really is a jurisdictional issue, you know, are all of these cases throughout the state of Ohio that doesn't mention the plea of arraignment when they say the jury verdict or the bench verdict is guilty, are all of those invalid cases? Are there no jurisdiction over any of these cases because we can't figure out what the arraignment plea was prior to the jury verdict of guilt?
So the big issue is how does one extricate themselves from all these different situations that now exist.
Your Honor, collaterally, that's a real issue that needs to be resolved.
Mr. Gallick, if I understand, the Ninth District is saying under 32C, you have to have one piece of paper that includes the plea and the verdict and the findings and the sentence. I mean, that they're looking for one sheet of paper that has all of those things sequentially. And it doesn't matter when they were journalized earlier, they want to have it all on one paper, and if that paper isn't sufficient, it's not a final appealable order.
That's exactly right, and the language in State v. Miller says that they are not going to search the entire record looking through journal entry after journal entry. Okay. So even if the plea was at arraignment, was journalized in January, and the person changed his plea and was convicted in October, they need to re-journalize that so that there's a single journal entry that the Court of Appeals can review.
And when you say if you were to lose, I mean, the litigation on this could be immense because there may be many entries out there in other districts where they are, for example, entering the verdict and the sentence, or the conviction and the sentence, without every single piece being here. Arguably, then, if you were to lose, all of these cases could be attacked on Rule 32C grounds.
Justice Lanziger, not to march the parade of horribles past the court, but I have some cases from 1998 I'd like to talk to you about.
Let me suggest, we've had these parade of horribles before when we've been asked to, as Justice Cupp said, sort of get people out of situations where they haven't followed the rules. And the sky hasn't fallen. I mean, the system hasn't come to a stop. We simply have told judges, this rule is so simple, it seems to me.
Yes.
And your proposition of law suggests that we just say the rule doesn't mean what it says. Criminal Rule 32C does not require a sentencing entry to contain the plea, and you have at arraignment.
Yes.
The rule says it does require that. So we have this conflict with saying to judges, you just simply follow the rule, or, yeah, the court didn't really mean what it said when it adopted Criminal Rule 32 many years ago. So it's okay because we got these judges who didn't do it right and counsel who didn't get it corrected, and so we'll take care of it by just saying the rule doesn't mean what it says. And we've had that argument before.
Your Honor, we haven't adopted that view. Your Honor, I respectfully disagree because I think that you have to look at the purpose of Rule 32C, and it's to look at the disposition of the case. It's not looking at interlocutory orders. A plea at arraignment is not appealable. There's no need for Criminal Rule 32 to address something that happens at the beginning of the case. It addresses what happens at the end of the case.
Well, you're arguing with the rule. I mean, you would suggest, I think, we change the rule. That's really your argument, isn't it?
No, Your Honor, I'm suggesting that the court say Criminal Rule 32C only addresses what happens at the end of the case, not interlocutory rulings that happen prior to disposition. And when it says plea and verdict, it really means plea or verdict. It's disjunctive, not conjunctive.
So, counsel, you would have the court, I think, state that the plea... substantial compliance would be sufficient on behalf of the trial judge, and that common sense would dictate the verdict as expressed in the journal entry through a jury trial would indicate a not guilty plea, so redundancy would take place if the not guilty was, the defendant pled not guilty and a verdict was had by a jury and found him guilty.
I agree with that reasoning, Your Honor, and I also agree with the 12th District's reasoning that if it's really important to know what the plea at arraignment was, and that journal entry exists prior to the sentencing journal entry.
Did you say if it's really important to know what the plea at arraignment was?
If the court says that, look, as the Chief Justice has indicated, Criminal Rule 32C requires us to have the plea at arraignment.
No, it doesn't.
I agree with Justice O'Connor. I agree, but.
Say anything about arraignment in this, and that's the point the chief made.
No,
you're inserting that. My reading would be that they want the plea, and that's the plea that precipitated the verdict.
Exactly.
Which would be the position the defendant took that got him to trial, which would be...
Yes.
Not guilty, which is common sense, and so what you're saying is common sense would dictate that we've got substantial compliance when we know via the journal entry that a verdict was had by a jury and that jury found him guilty.
Yes.
Okay, what happens, is there the possibility if we do go the opposite way and find that there has to be strict compliance with 32C, is that possible to make that prospective only in our actions? What's your thoughts on that?
Your Honor, if it's truly jurisdictional, I mean, the Ninth District says that you have to have a plea and the verdict or it's not a final judgment. So you have all of these journal entries where it only has the verdict and doesn't say what the plea was. Okay, there's a jury verdict of guilty. Well, okay, but what was his plea? So it's not a final order, so it's not jurisdictional. So if there's no subject matter jurisdiction, there's no subject matter jurisdiction.
And then would those sentences then be void?
Well, I certainly think that's the Ninth District reasoning,
mm-hmm.
that there hasn't been a valid sentence, and so all of these appeals are not ripe. For review.
What about just a resentencing?
Well, that's fine, Your Honor, but for every court in the state of Ohio to say, you know, everyone has to be resentenced and a new journal entry has to be drafted to integrate the plea and the verdict and the sentence all into the same journal entry, I just don't understand.
Well, I guess my thoughts were that cases that are already been through the appellate process would not be subject to this scrutiny and the need to redo anything, but those that pending, there's nothing to stop the individual being brought back to court, resentenced if necessary, or an order put on the record comporting with 32C. So, you know, it might be a little bit administratively inconvenient for some courts, but it doesn't open Pandora's box the way you're talking here.
Yeah, you know, I guess I can agree that such an order, such an opinion could be crafted and could mitigate the collateral consequences. But it's just to look at criminal 32C saying a plea and a verdict. It just, again, I've had this conversation with many trial judges over and over again, like, well, there's a jury verdict. There was no plea. And it's like, well, no, they're talking about the plea at arraignment is what they're talking about. And in the instant case, it was dismissed because we don't know what the plea was. Well, there was no plea. There was a jury verdict. And so it certainly seems to defy common sense that why are we talking about what his plea was if a jury convicted him? But apparently the Ninth District says that that means what was his plea? Did he plead not guilty at arraignment before the jury convicted him? And I think the common sense on that is rather self-fulfilling. I'm sure I've eaten into my rebuttal time, so I would like to thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gallick. Mr. Cassay.
Mr. Chief Justice, I support Richard Cassay representing the state of Ohio in this case. It's been said more than once that the law on what is a final order is a morass, and maybe this case is an example of it. But I think the first issue here is figuring out, or this court determining, what exactly is the conflict issue. Now, counsel for appellant has leaped to the conclusion, I think, that this case necessarily involves all ramifications of State versus Miller. Now, personally, I'm not necessarily opposed to that, because I think the more this court sees itself inclined to answer on this question, what does Criminal Rule 32C require, then that's going to be better for all the trial courts, all the defendants, and the state of Ohio. But the certified question, I think, can be fairly read to pose the question of whether under 32C, the judgment, whatever it's got to be in it, is one document or more than one document. And that is the real conflict, or the basic conflict, between Miller and Postway. Miller, of course, overruled the Ninth District in Miller, overruled its prior decision in State versus Morrison, which held explicitly that Criminal Rule 32B or C, whatever the version was in effect then, did not require one entry, two would suffice.
What do you think the answer to that question should
be? I think it's clear that one. I think it's just a simple reading of the rule, 32C, it is talking about a singular document.
And when you have a trial, therefore no plea has been entered, does that require an entry that also includes the plea at arraignment?
There's always a plea, Your Honor, with respect. Even if there is a trial, there is a plea. The rule...
You have a plea at arraignment that already has been journalized. You have to repeat that plea in your version in the entry.
In the Ninth District's version, yes.
Counsel... if that's to be the holding of this court, that the rule is the rule, and it's all got to be there in one document, for all of those cases where it's not there, are those sentences void or are they voidable?
Voidable. I don't think it affects the sentence. It affects the appeal.
Okay, and how fair is affecting the appeal when, as this defendant, the complaint is you've locked me up for more than the permissible time without getting me to trial. Now, if you say you can't appeal, then shouldn't the prosecutor be responsible for saying, okay, that's the rule here, and it isn't in there, and you're right, you're out of here. We dropped the ball, and instead of just saying, sit there some more.
I apologize. I'm struggling to see where and in what fashion the prosecutor is responsible for the court not entering a final appealable order. Now,
well, aren't both lawyers responsible to see to it that an order is a proper order?
Your Honor, if me, this person in front of you, or over in the office of the Summit County Common Police Court, drawing up the final entries, then they would all follow Miller. But we don't do that. Now, as a practical matter, when these cases started to be dismissed, I'm talking about things that aren't in the record, but I think appellate's counsel did the same thing. So to try to bring some sense of reality here, we will tell the trial court, you did not put this in. This is what you need. I've done that myself. You know, the same judge more than once, you know, unfortunately. But, you know, that has occurred. But that, I think that's off with respect, Your Honor.
Well, counsel, when that happened, they redid the journal entry. The time started to run then from that point forward for the appellate rights, correct?
Yeah, what the Ninth District is doing now, and let me back up a minute. Some of the early cases following Miller said the procedure is when Miller's not complied with, then you have to, the trial court has to construct or compose a proper judgment entry under Miller, mm-hmm. file it, and then the defendant has to file a new notice of appeal.
Right. And but, I mean, it just starts the process from, you know, whatever that date is forward. It doesn't deny the defendant a right to appeal, and it doesn't cause people to stay incarcerated longer than what the sentence was.
No.
And the volume of cases that was alluded to by the defendant, have you experienced that with a inordinate or an abundance of cases being rejected by the Ninth District and the trial court not fixing the judgment to comport with Rule 32C?
Well, I'll try to answer that question, but it's obviously has a subjective component to it. Initially, when Miller was decided, we had a fair amount of cases, and the cases that I've cited in the brief, I think all were this rush after Miller, okay, we're going to dismiss this appeal. That has, in my experience, which is limited to Summit County, half of the appellate docket, in my experience, that has dried up, not completely, because some judges, unfortunately, will stray off the reservation, or at least what the reservation that Miller has constructed. The problem now, if it's a problem, is that the journal entries that are being questioned are those that do not dispose of all the charges in the single journal entry. That's an important question. I don't know that it's encompassed in the conflict question, but that's another aspect of the Ninth District jurisprudence. But
is that there's multiple convictions and sentences, and it's not all put in one journal entry?
Here's an example of what happens. Okay, the defendant pleads. He enters a plea bargain. 3-count indictment, 2 counts dismissed. He enters the plea to 1. The initial entry is, and the court orders a PSI. So the initial entry is going to recite the plea, and it's going to say counts 2 and 3 dismissed. Mm-hmm. Sentencing postponed until XYZ date. So we have the sentencing date, and he comes in, the defendant comes in for sentencing, is sentenced. The journal entry, where it's a problem, will not recite that counts 2 and 3 were dismissed.
They just recite the count that he
correct.
Was convicted of or pled to, and they
yes.
say the defendant pled to count 3, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
You think that's a problem?
Do I think it's a problem? No, I don't think it's a problem. I'm saying an aspect of the Ninth District jurisprudence here is that besides the Miller structure, you have a later case, State versus Goodwin, that I've cited in the brief, but not discussed at any length. But I'm talking about it because I'm talking about current problems.
So what you're saying is the Ninth District is saying no jurisdiction for appeal if you don't recite the other two?
Yes, that's correct.
So there's a tail out here that we don't see at this point.
Yes, I guess I'm revealing it.
Yeah.
It's not a secret, Your Honor. But the point I was starting to make initially is that...
So you would like us to address that if we can make the language broad enough and the answer to the certified question to, by implication, cover the other issue, we should do it, is what you're suggesting.
Your Honor, I think it would be beneficial for the state, the defendants, and the trial courts, for this court to say as much as it thinks it can properly say on this subject.
About what the word plea means.
What
kind of plea? I mean, that's what you're asking us to do here, is define what the plea means in Rule 32C.
Yes, Miller defines it as, I'm sorry.
I understand.
Or you're not going as broad, Mr. Cassay, to say you want to know what a judgment of conviction means under 32C? I mean, that to me is the bigger issue. I know that the certified question talks about whether the plea at the indictment needs to be in. That's how the question is phrased. But when you look at 32C and you say a judgment of conviction shall, and then you have this series with an or, and then you have and sentence. It's a parsing of that entire sentence, I think, that is causing all the problems.
I agree 100%.
Okay.
I'm just saying the certified question can be interpreted narrowly, mm-hmm. but in my view, if the court were to take a more expansive view of the narrow question, it would benefit everybody.
What was your reference to the Goodwin case?
Goodwin? Are you asking for the cite, Your Honor?
No. I thought you had a point you wanted to make.
Well, Goodwin was the case that authored by Judge Dickinson, who is only following Miller, by the way, as a matter of stare decisis. But in Goodwin, the issue was whether or not the judgment entry under 32C has got to dispose of all the charges brought against the defendant. The majority in that case says yes. Now, the charges were not disposed of because there was one count, a minor misdemeanor, that the majority in Goodwin said there was no sentence. Okay, so that was different than the example that I gave the court before about the pleas or the dismissed counts not being in the final entry. But the Ninth District has applied Goodwin to that circumstance also.
So in Goodwin, the trial court just forgot about one of the charges.
In Goodwin, it was a minor misdemeanor, and the trial court said fine of no dollars, zero. The majority in Goodwin says that's not a sentence. The Ninth District had conflicting opinions on that.
This
on
canvas
that subject.
Is getting pretty large that you're asking us to paint.
It doesn't have to be.
Well, counsel, do you think that the Rule 32 violation, if we find it is a violation all these times that the, and I guess affirm what the interpretation of 32 by the Ninth District, would that open the door for resentencing at all?
It might.
Under what circumstances would you envision that a resentencing would be necessary, or you can't I would presume, see a time when the defendant would use this as a grounds to revoke a guilty plea?
Well, yes, I'm sure they'll try, yeah. There's not an easy answer, because if you say, well, all you have to do is resentence him, the Ninth District would say you have to have a complete new journal entry.
Couldn't that just be a non-proton?
It's a non-proton if the non-proton standing in and of itself is a judgment of conviction under 32C. In other words, if the initial entry that they find, that the Ninth District finds fault with, does not contain the plea, and the trial court nunk-pro-tunks it to say what the plea was, and that's all the nunk-pro-tunk does, the Ninth District says you still don't have a judgment under 32C because we want one document, not two.
It wouldn't be that, I still, it
it's not
be
that, that difficult
it,
to
it
do,
It wouldn't be
Judge.
That difficult to do a nunk-pro-tunk entry that follows the rule, would it? You put everything in it.
I don't think so.
I mean, if that's
so.
What we say, the trial court goes back and does nunk-pro-tunk.
Well,
although nunk-pro-tunk usually is a clerical error, and maybe that's what this could be.
Situations, though, can be a little more complicated if you have multiple counts and you have a case that would take, that has gone a fair distance in the court. We all know files that are very large and have numerous journal entries throughout. It sounds as though what we would be talking about is making sure that this judgment of conviction under 32C captures every single point at every single point of the case in the final order that the Court of Appeals for the Ninth District says is a final appealable order.
If this court reaches the State versus Goodwin, that would be necessary. It's kind of ironic, but Jermaine Baker has another case, not this case, but he has another criminal conviction which is presently on appeal in the Ninth District, and that situation was much more complicated than this, and that very issue arose where I had to sit down and go through multiple journal entries. There were about 30 counts, so I had to figure out what happened. Then we have to tell the trial court, this is what you got to do. So that can happen, and happened with Jermaine Baker. I'm almost out of time. I think this is a very interesting subject, but I think the bottom line to defend the Ninth District here is that they are strictly construing Criminal Rule 32C. Now, either they can do that or they can't. There's been talk about substantial compliance. If, to my mind, you don't have substantial compliance when you read out the word plea, that's more than substantial compliance. I think you're rewriting the rule. Now, you can do that if you want, but I don't think it can call it substantial compliance. It's a rewriting.
Although, counsel, you could read the words in disjunctive because it says plea, verdict, or findings, meaning that the series is disjunctive.
That gets us into Judge Dickinson's theory, his concurrence in State versus Williams. So we can go on. I can go on all day with this.
You've already gone 2 minutes over your time.
I know.
So.
I'm over. I'm sorry.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr.
But that
Fisay.
Is Judge Dickinson's theory.
Thank you. Mr. Gallick, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to agree with much of what opposing counsel said, that whatever this court decides, at least it will be a decision, and we have some idea of what's going on. And the one undercurrent throughout all this, the overwhelming majority of these cases are indigent appeals, where you have attorneys, and there aren't many attorneys dumb enough to try and take an issue like this all the way to the Supreme Court, except for me. Especially, there's also an issue about whether or not you can even be appointed on these cases, and there's a motion pending before this court where it says you can't even appoint counsel for an indigent appeal unless you are defending the Ninth District opinion, not going against it. Whatever this court decides, it's definitely going to increase the knowledge of everyone, so where we know what's appealable and what's not.
What happens if we reverse and find that, whether we use the disjunctive analysis or we use that there's multiple entries that you can read together to get the final decision, whatever rationale we use, what happens to all those indigent appeals that have not been filed because they now had a final entry way back when, but their 30 days have run.
I'm not smart enough to answer that question. It's between March of 2007 and whenever this decision is made. I don't know if the court could recommend, you know, that the Ninth District be very generous in granting leave to appeal for a delayed appeal. Saying that
their decision is what prohibited the appeal.
Yes.
And if you say that they had 30 days from the original entry, which is now valid,
yes,
you've really taken away the rights to appeal by what the
that is a risk. And certainly that's what Judge Carr was saying in her dissent, that we have a lot of people in prison who don't know what to do, and their attorneys don't know what to do, and their trial judges don't know what to do. You could say if it's a case between March of 2007 when Miller was issued and the decision of this case, that those attorneys should consider filing a delayed appeal, and the Ninth District should be very generous in granting leave to file delayed appeal, since what's causing the delayed appeal is the Ninth District decision. And I think that probably would be justice in this situation. And in the instant case, Justice Stratton, if the court says it means plea or verdict or findings in the disjunctive, then our case is fine and we're ready to file the appeal on the merits, because we don't have a plea, but we have a jury verdict resulting in guilty.
The problem is it doesn't say the plea or. There's a comma after plea, which is not disjunctive.
You're correct, Your Honor. The or is between verdict or findings. It doesn't say plea or findings,
right,
or verdict.
Right.
So I just
Thank
want
you.
A second or.
Thanks, Mr. Gallick.
Thank you, Chief.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal, please adjourn court.
All right. Hear ye.
Thank you.